Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Alan Levy Show at blogtalkradio.com. Be prepared to call in now and chat with Alan and his very special guest right here at blogtalkradio.com. With no more further ado, please welcome your host, Mr. Alan Levy.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm the founder and CEO of Blog Talk Radio, and it's truly an honor to be with you today. It's 11 a.m. on Tuesday, March 23rd. As always, the Alan Levy Show can be listened to live at blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy, or you can listen to it on demand at any time you'd like at the same address or on iTunes. Just search for Alan Levy, and you'll find my show on iTunes. We'll be taking your calls today towards the end of the show, and if you'd like to call in and ask a question of our guest, the phone number to call in is 866-691-7714. That's 866-691-7714. My very special guest today is Lester Wunderman. Lester Wunderman is an advertising legend, the pioneering father of direct marketing. Lester created, among other iconic direct marketing campaigns, the American Express card, the use of 800 toll-free numbers to sell magazines, and the concept of direct mail campaigns. Lester is Chairman Emeritus of Wunderman, one of the largest networks of advertising, marketing, and consulting companies in the world. Lester, it is a pleasure and an honor to speak with you today. How are you?
Well, I'm just fine here, and it's a pleasure to talk to you over this great distance.
Wonderful, wonderful. So we met in your offices a little more than a month ago, and I had the pleasure of meeting you for the first time. We were talking in your office, and you were sharing some of your incredible insights and experiences. So I thought it made sense to bring you on the show so our audience, the Blog Talk Radio audience, as well as your employees around the world could listen in on this, either live or at their leisure, to get some insight into some of your experiences.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with that. I think it's such a good idea.
Yeah, well, wonderful. Yeah, we were chatting about how you were thinking about it, the so many of the meetings that you had been to in your life and your career, and how you would have liked to record them and memorialize them so you can share those with your employees, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've written this book, which is being published in China, Being Direct, which has my biography, you know, from almost birth on, but how we started the agency and how we got our first clients and what the principles of the agency have been that were different from other advertising groups.
Right. And I'm really excited. And the name of the book, of course, is Being Direct, and you're about to head off to China. I want to talk about China and your view on Asia. And so I thought maybe before we get into the book, and I guess you did cover it in the book, can you give our audience a brief description of your background, how you got started in advertising, and then in particular with direct marketing?
Well, it's difficult to be brief, but I started in advertising with an older brother. I had a brother who was 3 years older than I. And he had some experience in advertising, and I had none. And as young people, we were casting about for how we should live our lives and what we should do as work. And I was always interested in writing and persuasion, and was always interested in other cultures. So we decided that we would open an advertising agency, which we did. We opened it with the smallest amount of capital that one can imagine. My mother, who was a widow, had one piece of jewelry left to her by my father, who had died when I was nine. And she sold that piece of jewelry to give us the capital to open our first advertising agency. So we opened with little capital, not a lot of knowledge, but a great deal of energy and ambition.
And it wasn't called an agency, was it not? Was it called a service?
It was called the service because we did everything. I would wander buildings, starting at the top floor and visiting office by office and trying to sell what I could, whether it be printing or any other form of promotion. And I encountered that way. I got a quick education in the nature of the businesses that emanated from New York. And I learned New York in a way I'd never known it. And as we learned and got some clients and got some work, we became more proficient at it. Not having the background of advertising experience, we decided that we had better take a special form of advertising as our specialty. And we then decided that this direct idea of direct communication with the end consumer by the manufacturer was going to be the way that business would be done starting at that point. Now, we're talking about a time prior to the development of the computer. We worked with the two universities that were developing computers. We understood the United States Army had a network like the Internet, and it was called the ARPANET at the time. And then as the Internet developed, I worked with the founders of the Internet, and I realized that this would become the first major personal medium that the world had known since direct conversation.
I want to get into that, but we have to go back to a little earlier. I just want to ask you a couple of things, if you don't mind. And I want to ask you in particular the concept that you called the Mrs. Schwartz rule of service. Can you explain what the Mrs. Schwartz rule of service is?
Yes, indeed. Well, when I was in school and my family was needy, we were poor, and my father having been long dead, and we had to earn some money. There was no money in the household. And I got a job delivering chickens for a butcher in part of New York City. Not an upscale part of New York City, I might add. But what happened is on Friday, the typical New York system in that area was that women would buy chickens on Friday and have chicken soup and chicken over the weekend. So the chickens, and they didn't want to carry their own chickens, I mean, for whatever reason. And so I would be piled up with, I didn't have a bicycle, I didn't have a wagon, and what the butcher would do is load me up with maybe 50-pound bag, you know, bags of chickens, and I would walk up. The women who wouldn't carry their own chickens usually lived in apartments without elevators and usually lived on the higher floors, which is why they wouldn't carry their own chickens. So I must say I got a lot of exercise walking up and down floors carrying chickens.
But I wanted to say, I mean, the interesting concept here, right, came up with a very important concept from that, right?
I did indeed. Now, there was a woman named Mrs. Schwartz, and Mrs. Schwartz lived on the top floor of one of these buildings that you had to walk up, and she lived on the sixth floor, so I carried her chicken up six flights, and she gave me a 5-cent tip. Now, in those days, 5 cents was a lot of money, but it isn't today. And I said, Mrs. Schwartz, how come the women in the fancy apartments that have elevators only give me 2 cents and you give me 5 cents? And she said, Lester, I need you more. Well, that was my understanding of the Mrs. Schwartz philosophy. when the consumer needs you more, when an advertiser needs you more, or if you can create the feeling that they need you more, you're much more likely to make a sale and be thought of as providing appropriate service.
Right. So I thought it was a great story, the Mrs. Schwartz rule of service, but I think that the concept, and particularly for those in the advertising industry, is so important to any organization, anyone providing a service, selling a product. And I think I'm quoting you that the pricing of services should be based upon the value of the services provided.
That's correct.
Right. And that, of course, is a rule that continues to certainly live to this day. And just by extension, if the pricing of services is based upon the value of service provided, then by extension, measuring of the value of services must be a fundamental requirement of marketing, and I guess in your view.
Well, it certainly is, and it's one of the things that we innovated in a way. Advertising had always been a general expression by an advertiser through mass media and who provided the same message to the total audience. We began to believe that a more direct, more personal, more informed, information-based messages would be more effective. To do that, one then had to gather information about the people to whom you were selling. And my knowing that Mrs. Schwartz was up on the sixth floor and that would provide a service to her led to an understanding of what I call the Mr. Schwartz rule of service, that you get paid for the service you provide, and if you're innovative, you learn to provide additional services, even those that do not at the time exist. And, of course, technology in our industry has been the revolutionary source of change.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, Being Direct, you developed the Wonderman Rules, which, of course, are the kind of 10 commandments, or let's say 19 commandments of direct marketing. Just a few of them that I pointed out, I'll just note here. One of them, the first, direct marketing is a strategy and not a tactic. It's not an ad with a coupon. It's not a commercial with a toll-free number. It's not a mailing, a phone call, a promotion, a database, or a website. It's a commitment to getting and keeping valuable customers. Another one, it's called the next step, profitable advertising. The results of advertising are increasingly measurable. They must now become accountable. Advertising can't be just a contribution to goodwill. It must become an investment in profits. And the last one that I thought was important and very appropriate to this conversation we're having, as well as what's happening on the web today, is encourage interactive dialogues. Listen to consumers rather than talk to them. Let them advertise their individual needs. They'll be grateful for your responsiveness. Convert one-way advertising to two-way information sharing. These are formidable. This is the Bible, so to speak, of direct marketing. First question is, why only 19? I mean, how did you come up with such a random number?
It just became 19. And I thought of as many as I could. And then when it turned out to be 19, I thought, well, let's stop here because there's something wonderful about the number 19.
What is that? What's wonderful about the number 19?
I don't know. That numbers, as you know, numbers have their own attraction to people. I mean, there are games in which the number 7 or 11, become very important. But it just seemed to me that 19 was an appropriate. The 20 would have been oversell and overkill and get boring. And being less than that would not have explained the technology or the system or the thinking well enough.
I think I found out actually one of the reasons why, looking at the bio on my screen here of you, it says Wonderman, an advertising executive who began his career in advertising in 1933 at the age of 19. I don't know if perhaps the 19 I don't know. That may be just a coincidence, but
That's a misprint. I was 19 in 1939.
I see. Okay. Well, then, but I guess I'm not as smart. Let's talk about the 19 rules. I mean, how have the rules stood up to today's environment? I mean, have you thought about increasing them, modifying them? I know it's a very broad and general question, but just generally, do you feel like that they still stand the test of time?
Yeah, I think they do. And I think that another generation and other thinking will add to them or change them. But for my time, and with technology available to us, and our awareness of the consumer, I think they were the 19 appropriate things. If I had to rewrite it today, I guess I might change some. I think there are some I would take out and others I would modify, but I don't plan to do that. I might do it when I speak, as I will be in my approaching trip to both trips to Japan and China. And I will be speaking, and I will be providing some additional things that I think have become important.
Right. And, of course, the world has changed with the web and of course, what we're seeing now. And I want to get a little – I want to talk more about China a little later on. Once again, we're speaking with Lester Wunderman on the Alan Levy Show. The phone number is 866-691-7714. Now, of course, there's so many major marketing campaigns that you've created over the years, and I want to get into a few of them, if you don't mind, and really to helpful to understand your approach to solving your clients' problems. So, you know, how does the process start? And I think that will be very helpful. And so how do you approach it when you go into existing a client that is looking to release a new product or a new one that you're looking to pitch? What's your process of thinking about it?
Well, the process certainly begins, in our case, begins and ends with the consumer. That's what do consumers need? What are they likely to need? Or what is it possible to make them, to introduce ideas to them that they approve of? So that our thinking all begins with the consumer. And we're trying as much as possible, and it gets more possible all the time, to be relevant. Advertising at its outset was totally irrelevant, or almost totally irrelevant, because it provided the same message to everyone, no matter what their psychography or demography. They got the same message, and no matter what they needed or what their economic status was. And it was clear that if we could learn more about the consumer and not only their demography and what their economic status was, but what were their preferences for products, that we could do the ultimate work of advertising, which is to make a customer for an advertiser. The ultimate work is not to make a product well known. The ultimate work is to create customers who buy and buy again, and that's been the psychology and that's been the basic tenet of this company.
No, it's wonderful to hear that. So let's talk about the American Express card. You know, it's a remarkable story. I'd love our audience to hear about it. Of course, it's one of the most famous, it's iconic. Tell us about how that happened and, you know, that story, the American Express card.
Well, American Express, we were a small agency, and American Express somehow found us and gave us an assignment. They said, come and look at our business and see what new services, because they were essentially in the travel arrangement business. That was American Express. if you were booking travel, you booked it to American Express. And they said to me, how do we expand our franchise? What else should we be doing? And I did a 50-page report to them, having done a consumer research. And in this report, I described the idea of a credit card that would be superior to any then existing. The first credit card in America that I know of was the Diners Club, and that was limited to restaurants. And I thought American Express, being a service company that provided travel as well as arrangements for restaurants, hotels, theaters, etc., that a card that would be a payment for all such services would be something special. It would be almost like another form of money, that carrying that card, you were carrying money that you otherwise, in amounts that you otherwise wouldn't dare do. So that the service of being able to pay at the widest variety of retail providers for all sorts of services was the original idea for the American Express card, and I thought they were the appropriate company to do that. And that's how that began. And we made a report, and nothing happened for 5 years. They accepted the report, they paid, and I thought, my God, I must have done something wrong. 5 years later, they called me up and they said, let's begin. And so the American Express card started. We helped design the first card. We helped design what its services should be. And then we helped American Express use their card members as customers for a whole range of things that both American Express and its services could offer.
That's a wonderful story. What about 800 services for Time Magazine? I mean, that's another. Was this just generally 800 services? The concept of enabling your customer to call in toll free, or was it that you implemented for Time? Or did you develop that toll free? The concept of toll free numbers.
Well, we wanted to use, direct marketing as it was known, or direct mail as it was known, was limited to certain media. We wanted to get onto radio and television because we saw that they were the growing, we didn't know yet about the internet, but these were the growing media. We had to find a way for consumers to respond easily. And to give complex phone numbers or to give complex addresses took too much time, and people didn't have pencil and paper to write them down. So we suggested to AT&T that they start the 800 number, an 800 number, so that people could call advertisers freely, and it expanded the business enormously.
As well as AT&T's.
Oh, indeed.
That's remarkable, right? I mean, think about the impact 800 services have done for AT&T, a highly differentiated service and outrageously priced for that. So you benefited both, and you've changed both industries. I mean, two dynamics, the phone market, the phone companies, as well as the brands.
And as well as the nature of marketing. Because suddenly, and this is certainly the increasing trend, people who make things want to talk to people who buy them. And the old system of distribution through a series of wholesalers and distributors is clumsy. So this 800 number was efficient, easy to remember, and it cut right through instead of going through the old addressing and so forth, problems.
That's a remarkable, impactful, campaign. Two other questions here. Which is the best? Which is the client? The biggest regret of you? Of course, you're pitching for years and years. I mean, do you remember any particular campaigns you didn't win that you regretted? I'm sure there's many. Is there anything that really sticks out to you as ones that you didn't get that maybe you ultimately got back?
Well, I guess it probably was American Express that I made the report and we didn't get the advertising. It was done, as it still is, largely through Ogilvy and Mather. And we became the second agency at American Express because we brought some new thinking to them about their services and how they should be promoted. And I guess I had as much fun with American Express.
Do any other campaigns come to mind that you did not create that you really were very impressed with? Like, what's one of the top marketing campaigns that you didn't create that you could recall that you were very impressed with?
Well, let's see. I was always impressed, by the way, with the campaigns for American Express, which we did not create. I thought their advertising then and now has been exceptional. When you think about now all the credit cards, the American Express has just retained its position as the leader, and it simply stays different. They are a service company and committed to service. And I think their advertising, done by another agency, is always different and interesting.
Okay. So in the preparation of this interview, Andrew and I were chatting, Andrew Sexton, and he suggested I bring up the story about Procter & Gamble, who you referred to as the House of Clean when you went into a pitch. Maybe you could share that story with our audience. I think it would be enlightening.
Well, it's embarrassing. What in fact happened is we were asked to make a presentation to Procter & Gamble, and Procter & Gamble being, one of the world's largest advertisers, to come to an agency such as ours was strange, but they knew we were doing something different, and they were interested in finding out what it was. So I packed a large presentation case with samples of our work so that I could really lecture to people at Procter & Gamble that there were different ways of going to market than the ways that they were using, and that we could provide them with outlets that they didn't have and information that they didn't have. So I made this, my hard-earned opening remarks, and I had this big black sample case that carried all of the material that we wanted to show them. And when it came to the dramatic moment after I made my speech, and I said, now I'll show you how advertising should work and how it should work for Procter & Gamble. And I opened up the zipper of this case, and out walked the biggest, blackest New York cockroach that you've ever seen. And here I am in the House of Clean, in the board of directors, in the director's room. I mean, if a cockroach ever got inside Procter & Gamble, they would move.
And what was their reaction? Did you win the business?
Well, what I did is the first thing I did is I slapped the cockroach. I mean, the cockroach was gone. And then I said to them, I said, who should sue American Airlines, you or us? Because clearly we had put this bag on the plane without a cockroach, and somehow between New York and their offices in Cincinnati, this cockroach got involved.
Of course,
and
there are no cockroaches in New York City.
I guess in recollection, one would have to assume it was one of our best of New York's finest cockroaches. And but we didn't stop to admire it. It didn't. So I slapped it down.
Yeah.
And you know, wanted to know who and blamed it on American Airlines. Poor people. But they never suffered from.
Right. And did you win the business, or were your ideas?
Yeah, we did. We did.
You did. So
we got
the
an
lesson.
Assignment.
So that's a lesson for all of us.
I think, you know, it turned out, instead of being a fiasco, it turned out to be kind of a piece of showmanship. I mean, nobody had ever brought a cockroach to Procter & Gamble before, and nobody ever would.
Well, that's a wonderful story. So you're listening to a conversation with Lester Wunderman on the Alan Levy Show. So I wanted to talk a little about the advertising industry, and over the years, there's been so many interesting and dynamic personalities. Of course, I have to ask you, as a big fan of the TV show Mad Men, is Mad Men an accurate portrayal of ad agency life in the late 50s?
Well, yes, I think it is. I don't watch it because I lived it. In other words, there's nothing they put on that show that didn't, in fact, happen to us. So, you know, we had our own Mad Men show back in the 50s.
Are you referenced in it at all? Were you portrayed in it? I know there are other leading characters in Campbell and other icons. Were you?
You know, frankly, I don't know because I don't watch it. It isn't because I don't think it's interesting or useful. It's stuff I already know. I mean, what goes on that show, I saw happen in real life. And in real life, it is enormously dramatic. Some of the things that happen to the lives, clients, ambitions, and of people, how their life has changed and either enriched or becomes disappointing, how products grow or don't, how companies thrive or fail. We've been through all that. And the show is amusing and I find it wonderful, but I'm not a watcher. I'm not a viewer.
Okay. So, of course, there's been a tremendous amount of consolidation in the agency world over the years, dating back then and prior and, of course, today. And you've seen your share of consolidation. Maybe you could explain your relationship with David Ogilvy and kind of what transpired when you ultimately sold your agency, Wunderman, Cato & Johnson, to Young & Rubicam.
Well, what happened, David and I had become good friends. And David's number two man, Jock Elliott, was also a great friend of mine. And the Elliots and myself and my wife saw each other frequently socially. And David, of course, had his house in France, and I subsequently had one there, too. So, I mean, we interested each other. And so David offered to merge with us. And I was terribly tempted to do so, but there was one problem. Ogilvy and Mather had become a public agency, I think it was the first one or the second, to sell its shares to the public. I thought at that point that the people who work in an advertising agency and actually do the work should hold the shares and earn the profits, that the profits that having its third-party profits, profiteers who were not part of the process was not a good idea for service business. So I did not merge with David Ogilvy because Ogilvy and Mather were a public company. I merged with Young & Rubicam because they had equal stature, equal reputation, very good clients, and they had vowed never to become public. And I thought that was a good idea. Of course, that didn't last very long. That under the pressures of expansion, most large agencies became public because it was the only way to get access to capital to build the network. Even a company such as ours has offices in, so many countries. And opening an office and opening a continent or a country is a very expensive proposition because you don't go in there making a profit. You've got to build your way. And so capital was a necessary ingredient in building an agency network. And so I was wrong. And Young & Rubicam eventually went public. And I don't think anything has been lost in the way of service. I was just, I guess, stubborn at that point.
So when you started, I guess, thinking about global, I mean, even when you were, when did you really start thinking about the need to be global in order to be local?
Well, right away. That is, we quickly, in our early years, we opened in Canada, which was necessary because so many U.S. media flow over into Canada. And then we opened in Mexico because there was some degree that was the same thing, and they were adjacent countries and easier to manage. And then, of course, we realized we had to open in Europe, and we started in London. Our first European company was in London, and then we made a relationship with a large French advertising agency where we became a separate system with them. And slowly we began to cover all of Europe, and then eventually, of course, we went to Asia. And being in Asia, of course, is where I think the growing opportunity is. Every time I go to China, I think if I were to be born again, maybe I would choose to be Chinese. The opportunity is there for growth, and, the fact that capitalism is working, industries are growing, consumers are learning, that it's kind of almost a replication of what happened in other countries in the West. And the system is going through in China, and we have six offices in China. I mean, that's how important we think it is.
I see. And, of course, you're heading to China in April to, on your book, Being Direct is being translated, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
It will be published in Chinese.
It'll be published in China. And, of course, one of the things I was reading through in the book where you just describe early on, actually, in the first, in the profile or the beginning of your conversation with Guan Qicheng, the minister of Post and Telecommunications, who was sitting there with you and talking, and you were describing through the translator of what your view was about how direct mail could impact and the creation of a global database and things. I mean, this is a fascinating story. Maybe talk a little about that and kind of what your What do you see with the billion people in a government that controls this, communication and privacy? It's quite fascinating what's happening in China.
Well, in the first place with Zhuan Guichang, he and I just became friends. Quite apart from the fact that he had an interesting history. He had been put in prison for 20 years for preaching communism during the Chiang Kai-shek era, when, in fact, the communists took over China. He was freed, and because as a prisoner he had been a mail carrier, they made him head of the post of China Post, because he had, was the only one in government that had any experience with how letters should get delivered. And that was the state that China was in at that point. But China, of course, is, you know, is now under capitalist energy, and the country is changing and growing, and that's why we have six offices there, and we just see it, it's just bursting. I mean, China, I mean, every company in any industry wants to be in China at this point, because with that many consumers and with now computer communication, it's just going to be a place for people to grow. And that's why I have said that to be born again, I could be born in China and go through the same career.
Oh, much bigger. But when you look at the privacy matters in China, where, you know, the government is controlling so much of the communication medium, is it, do you see that as an enormous opportunity to kind of control commerce in a much more powerful way via direct marketing, because you have all this information, you can influence so many more people?
Well, I you know, have had these visions of China. I don't, you know, we don't get involved in the politics of a nation. What we do is work within the systems that they make available to us. And we have six offices in China, and we make no criticism of either plus or minus of what they do politically. All we know is that we can get mail delivered, we can get advertising delivered, we can get consumers to buy products, and for us, it's an open market. Its political ramifications don't change as they don't in any other country. I mean, we have offices, you know, in countries of any political persuasion, and we're just not part of that system.
Right. So if we just move on to today's environment, and one of the questions in the chat room is, how does the, in your view, the advertising of, you know, they say yesteryear, let's say, you know, compare with what's happening now? I know it's a broad statement, but do you see substantial trends? And I don't want to get into social networks yet. I want to talk about that in a moment. But are there any broad strokes that you're seeing changes in approach and strategy?
Yeah, I mean, copy is shorter. I mean, if you take a look at the advertising of 50 years ago, it was almost all copy. And I think what's happened is that advertising has become much more pictorial and imageic, and particularly under the influence, you know, of media such as television, it's simply become a much more, the visual component is much more important. Agencies, when I began, had a copy chief, but they didn't have a creative director. They had a copy chief and they had an art director, the art director being a subordinate person, because the visual was not as important as the content and copy. That, of course, has changed. And we're now looking at visual impressions and visual media, and I think the emphasis there has changed, and the nature of the talent that agencies sponsor is different. We're looking for different kinds of people. I used to hire English teachers because I thought I could teach them the right copy. Well, I'm not sure that I could hire an English teacher and teach them to do what is now, you know, do an internet version. So it's just a different population, and we're just moving on.
Right. No, fascinating. With regards to television, I mean, the largest audiences you can reach via television, at least you know, and obviously Super Bowls and other large broadcasts and television in general. And, you know, there's a concept called cognitive surplus where there's a huge shift taking place, of course, that's coming online. What's your sense of the way audiences are fragmented and how advertising agencies, the challenges advertising agencies and brands have now to reach fragmented audiences? And as the dollars migrate, you know, how will that be all managed? Does it just put that much more challenge onto the agencies to figure it out?
There's a revolution going on which has not yet been named. I've named it, but it hasn't yet caught on, but I believe it will.
And what's your name?
And I think the future of advertising is called personal advertising. We have gone from masses and groups to individuals. That both the media make it possible, the internet makes it possible, the telephone makes it possible, the postal service makes it possible, and that advertisers now have to gather information about their consumers and prospects and try to create relevant messages. One message serving all is no longer the most efficient form of advertising. And I think as we grow, as the future approaches, the variety of messages will change radically to serve each medium.
And what about the concept, I fully agree, but what about the concept of audience and reach, and reaching those, getting those messages out to those audiences and scale that make a difference to the brands that you're providing services to?
Well, you know, the internet, we were one of the earliest agencies in the internet. I worked with the two men that I would never lose respect for, which one was Peter Drucker, the other was Nicholas Negroponte, one at the University of California and the other at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And they were the brightest men I ever met in the theory of marketing, and it was Negroponte who made the internet, and is still working as an internet person, creating internet, creating cheap computers for people in third world countries. That I have always been fortunate enough to know and understand and work with people who had the future in their minds. And so has this agency. And, you know, we've always looked into media as we are as good at the internet as we are at other media. And I think the internet has changed advertising from mass advertising to what I call personal advertising. And I think that's the future.
You're listening to Less Than One Bin on the Alan Levy Show. We have a few moments. If you like, you can call in at 866-691-7714. You were, when we were chatting in your office, you were talking about some of the fascinating places you've been. And I, you know, I mean, you talked about Senegal and, you know, dancing with the top person, lady in France, you know, but just, you know, as you're kind of traveling now and which you've always traveled, I mean, what are some of the highlights that you've seen from around the world and that come to mind, maybe some of those types of stories? A couple of them would be interesting.
Oh, I've had what I consider to be a great life. In Senegal, the head of Senegal, the president of Senegal, was the most famous French poet of his time. And we went, my wife and I went to, my wife had been a television journalist, and she and I went on our honeymoon to Senegal on our way to other countries in Africa. We were then introduced to the president of Senegal, and instead of having a visit of state, he being a poet, He took out a book of poetry and read it to my wife, signed it and gave it to her, took out another book of poetry, and our three-minute scheduled interview with him went to almost an hour, as he ended up having read six of his books and signing them over to her, and I still treasure them. He was an extraordinary man. He was a poet, a philosopher, as well as a statesman. And I got to know other parts of Africa. I myself became the brother of a chief of a tribe in Mali, and my wife and I were married there in a little village by the head that they call the Hogun. And we were married in a three-day ceremony in Mali, which I must say was interesting.
I would say, what do you mean you became a brother? You met these individuals and...
Well, they adopted me into their family, the chief. What happened, I had brought them... when I sold this company, Dion Rubicum, I kept some stock aside in a small foundation. That stock, of course, increased in value enormously. What I did then was to use the money to help this tribe who lived in an arid area of Africa in the country of Mali to send 13 young engineers from MIT over there to teach them how to catch water. In the Caribbean, people have learned almost by nature how to catch water during the rainy season so that they can save it for the dry season. In Africa, they didn't. And they were in terrible trouble during the summers. So what I did was take this additional money and send 13 young engineers over to this tribal headquarter village. And they taught people how to catch water on their roofs and store it and how to convert their silos into cisterns by lining them with ferro cement. So we changed after hundreds of years of thirst. This village, when we went there, the chief had 3,000 gallons of water, and he proudly told us about his 3,000 gallons of water as he prepared to marry us.
That is incredible. That's a remarkable story. That really is. So is there? There must be some sort of plaque over there, or something, or your name for on the dam of some the Lester Wunderman Pavilion of some sort.
Well, there is water,
right?
And they drink it, and you know, water is thought to be one of God's gifts, and it's tied in very much with their religion. I mean, the country that doesn't have it, it becomes spiritual because it comes from heaven. And so we were adopted into the religious leadership. And I have an African name, which is Amasagu. Amasagu, which is the name they gave me, which means beloved of God. And they gave me that name because I gave them water.
It's amazing. One of the questions in the chat room is, how do you get the energy at your age? I mean, I met with you. You have so much energy. You go into the office each and every day. What is it? Is it a diet? Is it your just thirst for knowledge? And just what is
it? Well, let me tell you, there was a pitcher in the Negro Leagues in America named Satchel Paige. Now, Satchel Paige was a man of great wisdom. And one of the things he said is, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you was? And I don't know how old I was. I never think of it. I don't think of chronology in terms of my own life. I think in terms of every day's requirements. and I make no concessions to it. And so far, I've been lucky.
No, it's wonderful. And, of course, the agencies are... You walk through the offices of all agencies around the world, and they're filled with youth and young people, and you know, and someone of your stature, you know, I think it's important for them to listen to these types of conversations and kind of learn how you the experiences you had, and so on. So I think it's wonderful, and I want to thank you for joining me here. We're just about up with the show, and it was a wonderful conversation with you. You're heading off to Asia in mid-April, I understand, right?
Yes, yes, that's true. We're heading off to Japan and China. And I have, they're publishing my book in Chinese. And so we're going there to introduce the book.
So maybe later this spring we'll have another opportunity. We'll get you on, and maybe you'll have your show, and you'll be able to interview some of these interesting personalities. It's a great honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you, and it's been likewise. Maybe next time I'll interview you.
I would love that. That would be quite an honor. That would be quite an honor. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to The Alan Levy Show with my guest, the special guest, Lester Wunderman. It's a fascinating story. I know I knew when I met Mr. Wunderman at his office and we started chatting, and we were talking a bit about Senegal and some of these other stories, that he truly has just a fascinating career. He's an iconic and a legendary figure, and someone who hasn't been in the advertising industry in my life, and only more recently over the last 4 years, and I've come to learn about what he's done and his agencies have done. I think it's very helpful to hear these stories. And, of course, I was pleased to talk about and learn the Mrs. Schwartz rule of service, by the way, which is something that I noted as I was reading the book, of a concept that I think is important for any organization, including Blog Talk Radio. And really, it's just, you know, the focus on what the value you're providing to the customer and to the end user. So I want to thank, once again, Lester Wunderman for being a guest on our show. The Alan Levy Show can be found at blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy. The archive of the show will be available probably within a half hour. And then, of course, you could always find it on iTunes. And look forward as well on our blog at Blog Talk Radio. Once again, thanks everyone for joining me, and have a great day.